Here's an excerpt from the 27th episode of the Federal Tax Updates podcast. In this episode, Blake Oliver joins Roger to discuss the latest news headlines on tax, including the recent court ruling that found the Corporate Transparency Act to be unconstitutional. The full episode will be available for download on Monday, March 11th. Make sure not to miss it.
So I've got this long list of stories that I've brought that I can't wait to talk about with you. And the first one just broke on Friday. Kelly Phillips Erb wrote a story on Forbes, and the headline is "Federal Court Rules New Company Reporting Law is Unconstitutional." And I feel like that title, that headline, doesn't quite do it justice, because the thing we've all been talking about for what feels like months now is this beneficial ownership information reporting with FinCEN, and that is all in question here, right, Roger?
Yeah, and you know, there's still, in my mind, a lot of misunderstanding and lack of knowledge about the whole thing in the first place, and you might just skip over that headline because you didn't even know that we have beneficial ownership reporting to do, particularly if you're a small business owner, maybe more than a practitioner. But yeah, I got a call today from Accounting Today, and they said, "What's your first comment?" And I said, "Well, something that was confusing to begin with and people were wrestling with just got more confusing, because now we have a court, and I think it was a court in Alabama, that just said it's unconstitutional." So I'm sure a lot of people are celebrating and they're thinking, "Wow, it's over. I don't have to deal with it." But as you know, Blake, it's never over till it's over.
No, and this decision is very different than like what you might expect, at least what I expected. It is a district court in Alabama, and this court, the judge in this court, Lyles C. Burke, ruled that the Corporate Transparency Act, which created this whole FinCEN reporting requirement, is unconstitutional. It exceeds the Constitution's limits on legislative branch and lacks a sufficient connection to any enumerated power to be a necessary or proper means of achieving Congress's policy goals. And he found that the CTA is unconstitutional because it doesn't regulate commerce on its face, contain a jurisdictional hook, or serve as an essential part of a comprehensive regulatory scheme, thus falling outside Congress's power to regulate non-commercial intrastate activity. And there were a whole bunch of other arguments in this case as to why this thing is unconstitutional, but the judge decided to just decide the case on the first matter, whether or not Congress has the authority under the Commerce Clause to do this. And the other really interesting thing about it is that it's limited to just the plaintiff at this point. Like, the judge didn't say that that like nobody has to follow this requirement. He just said that the NSBU, which is the National Small Business United group, and their plaintiff, Isaac Winkles, they're the only ones who don't have to report. And that's like 63,000, you know, members or something like that. So it's very interesting. Like, I guess my first question to you is, you know, what do you think of this decision? And then maybe we could go into, like, what does this mean for us and our clients?
Yeah, as far as, well, I'm not a lawyer, and certainly not a constitutional lawyer, so I don't know the merits of the case from a legal standpoint. Obviously, for a judge to come up with a ruling like this, there had to be something that concerned him or her. I think you can count on an appeal, so this isn't the last thing that will hear about it. The question is now, does this encourage other people to issue or have lawsuits in other courts in other parts of the country? Because it was limited, though it's impractical to say, well, we'll exclude this small group of small businesses and everybody else has to do it. So it's going to eventually settle out to everybody or nobody. But it's just throwing the whole thing into turmoil.
So I'm here in Arizona. And so for me, this doesn't actually change anything with my businesses, because the decision was limited to the plaintiffs in Alabama, or actually not the plaintiffs in Alabama, this group, if you were a member
of
the NSBU. or this one person, Isaac Winkles. So that's interesting, right? Like Treasury could just move forward and say, all right, fine, NSBU, you don't have to report, but everybody else does. That would be a very funny situation.
Yeah, then I think everybody else will go to court with the same argument. And, well, and then they'll say, but you can't just let them, you know, if it works for them, it's got to work for me. So, yeah, and I don't know. I read it, and, it, you know, it sounded like it was the plaintiff. Then it sounded like the plaintiff was the organization. So it's every member, no matter where they are. So yeah. From a potentially from a position of a firm who's going to offer this service, I guess you got to ask everybody that walks in, are you a member of this? Probably great for membership for the organization.
Right.
I wonder if you join after the ruling, if you're exempt, or if you had to join before the ruling.
I was listening to Ed Zollers on his show, and he was saying it's not clear, right? Maybe that could be the case, because in other situations that has happened, where if you joined after the fact, you now are part of the group and it counts. So that'd be funny if you know, the NSBU just decided to offer membership, you know, maybe get a discounted membership in order to be part of this. But
if they're any good at marketing, that's what they're doing right now. Should. They're coming up with their marketing campaign for new members.
The thing that is, you know, interesting to me about the decision, and, you know, I'm just an armchair constitutional lawyer here, Roger, is that, you know, I mean, I always have... I did learn in my civics class about how, you know, all the powers that are not explicitly given to Congress, the federal government, are reserved for the states. And,
right.
And you know, that's why we have this interesting regime where corporations are set up at the state level, not at the federal level. The federal government can only get involved if a corporation in a state is somehow crossing state lines,
right?
Doing business.
The interstate commerce.
The interstate, right? Interstate in between states. And so I, when this original rule came out, or this whole reporting requirement came out with FinCEN, I thought this is odd that the federal government can require my LLC in Arizona to give them information when perhaps my LLC in Arizona has never done any interstate business or commerce, right?
And yeah.
Like if I just do business here in Scottsdale where I live, and I never touch any other state or anyone in any other state, and I don't have online activities, why should the feds get my beneficial ownership reporting information?
Be able to regulate. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they've tried to, and they've been fairly successful in stretching interstate commerce to cover a lot of things that we wouldn't normally think we're dealing with. In other states, I know. Remember, one of the first things they did that caught a lot of people by surprise when it was if you took a credit card, then your company that monitored the credit card was somewhere else. So even though you weren't in any other state, didn't in your mind do business, and you were in interstate commerce because of taking credit cards. So they find very good ways to make us all be dealing with interstate commerce, even though, as you said, we're not. So, I mean, yeah, there's so many legal questions in it, and it comes at a time when we were all still trying to figure out what role, if any, in our audience, accounting firms could play in helping their clients even do this service. I've had a lot of discussions with people on Capitol Hill. I tell you, this is one of the most frustrating things I've ever had to deal with, because FinCEN's dealing with a group of businesses that they haven't typically dealt with, which is this small end, 20 or fewer employees, as the law, you know, states, under $5 million in revenue. These are businesses that are typically exempted from things like this, but instead they're the target. And I don't think FinCEN fully understands how that group of businesses operates and where they go and where they get information. I mean, I had a congressional staffer tell me the other day, one of the big hangups in the FinCEN is this idea that if your driver's license changes, you move, you get married, get divorced, whatever, you got 30 days to update your FinCEN report.
Yeah.
And I said, that's just not practical.
Who's going to remember to do that?
Well, particularly when it expires 7 years from now.
Yeah.
And I was told, I was told two things. One, I was told by a staffer, people have to take their credit card every time they go to the bank. I went, what bank do you bank with? I mean, no, they don't. I mean, not the credit card, their driver's license. So I said, no, they're not. They're not taking their driver's license to the bank every time they go. Then I was told by a staffer at FinCEN, people are just going to have to learn to adjust.
Good luck with that.
You know, this ain't going to work if those are the mindsets that you had to come up with this, and then that's your attitude to how this is going to work, because it's just not going to work that way.
So, I mean, we all know compliance is going to be a disaster, right? There will be some who comply, and there will be a lot who don't. And then the penalties are extreme for this group, right? I've never seen penalties this extreme other than like the foreign reporting requirements for small businesses. And so a lot of people are going to get really pissed off. And small business owners are very politically active. So, you know.
They're about to get more, I think.
Right. So, well, okay, to go back to this actual situation, what's going to happen next? There's going to be an appeal. That's going to take time. Right.
Right.
So there's a question as to whether this will even get resolved by the time the deadline hits, which is the end of this year for entities formed
last year
or before that.
Yeah, but for people formed now, they're in a 90-day clock.
Right.
There's no way this is going to get resolved in 90 days.
So is the best practice then to simply suck it up and file and just do it because it's better than, you know, getting a fine later or being found non-compliant, even if the law eventually is unconstitutional or changed somehow.
Yeah. You know, that's the problem we face right now. A lot of us are taking for businesses that were in business before the start of this year. The biggest advantage that we've had is we had time. We had till December 31st. So most of us have been advising our businesses to let's just wait. Let's hope that we get some change. Now, none of us anticipated this.
Right.
But that in our discussions with FinCEN and others that we could get some tweaks, some modifications, you know, like a clarification, you know, as you mentioned, the penalties are outlandish. They're $500 a day up to $10,000 chance to be criminal. And when you raise
you can go to jail
question,
for not filing,
you can
one
go
of
to
these.
Jail for not filing a form. Forget that you're not money laundering, which is the intent of this.
Yeah.
You know, you could be in jail next to a murderer because you didn't file a form. But you know, they say, "Well, we're not after the honest people. We're just well." When does someone's neglect become willful?
Well, and
you know,
who are the
just give
the
me
money,
the answer?
Are the money launderers really going to file these forms?
Of course not.
So it's they're going to have a database of honest people. You know, that they're prospecting.
Well, that's when you talk to them and you say, this just isn't going to work in the real world because I can identify fairly straightforwardly if someone owns 25% or more of a company, which is one of the requirements. But then there's this discussion about they have substantial control over certain activities. So if someone comes in my office and they go, well, I'm the 100% owner, and I ask them, well, is there anybody else that maybe could borrow money or fire you or something like that? If that somebody else is a money launderer, they're not going to tell me that.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So what is my responsibility? How far do I have to go to ask so that you don't come after me when you find out that Juan Guzman, whatever the drug lord from Mexico is, you know, running the business? You know, and you won't tell me that. You just tell me, don't worry, I'm not after the honest people. Well, put it in writing then, at least. Sorry, I don't take that as guidance.
Well, let's hope it gets resolved sooner rather than later. The easy fix would be for Congress to change the law so that it doesn't apply to every LLC or every business entity, but only those that do interstate commerce. The judge said in his decision that that would have been a good fix. So maybe they'll do that.
And there's some other tweaks. I think I get the 30-day clock for major changes. Like if you bring in a new partner, that's probably going to alert you that something changed that we need to think about.
Yeah.
So if you want to have 30-day change periods, make it for major things. And then take something like an address change or a document change on a piece of it. Make that an annual change that could be part of your normal filing. You know, you can tweak some things to relieve some of the pressure that we feel. But Congress, as you said, the judge gave Congress the blueprint to how to fix it.
I don't understand why they have this 30-day requirement anyway. Why isn't annual enough to start?
Here again, it's the belief that somehow filing all these forms, we're going to catch all the money launderers. So when you ask that question, they say, well, a lot can happen. you know, if you don't make them. Well, so a money launderer is going to say, oh, by the way, I got a new driver's license. So, you know,
yeah.
Come on, think about it in the real world. As you said, we're going to have a lot of forms filed by a lot of honest people. Maybe what they're trying to do is then trap you because you didn't disclose somebody. So they got, I don't know.
Yeah.
Someone told me FinCEN's total employment is 342 people.
That's a lot of people too. I mean, yeah, it feels like it.
Not to administer a form that impacts like 20 million businesses. I mean,
I guess you're
IRS
right. It's like the same with the SBA, right? Like the SBA had to do all this work during COVID and they only had a few hundred people. It never worked.
Yeah. How do you enforce it?
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have auditors like the IRS does. IRS has more auditors in one city than you've got total employees, because that includes the janitors, the secretaries, everybody.
It's a really good question, Roger. How do you enforce it when you don't know what you don't know?
Right. Right.
So if somebody doesn't file, how will the federal government ever know that that entity even exists?
Well, and if they do file and leave off the money launderer, how are they?
Right.
If
they
can't
leave off
find out, how are you going to find out?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, how are you going to, for these, again, these things that aren't necessarily ownership. Yes.
Right.
If I register my company and I tell you that Blake Oliver owns 100% of a company, then you know that. But if you don't know.
This is a really good point. Yeah. Like the money launderer, the one that you want to know about is never on the business filings. So do you think that the business owner of record is really going to rat out that person? No chance. No,
not for long. Not from what little I know about the kind of people who launder money, they're probably not real happy if you rat them out.
Yeah.
So,
this is getting, I feel after this conversation, Roger, I feel like this is more ridiculous than ever. And I feel like before I get outraged, we should probably move on to other topics.
Yeah.